Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Podfix Network.
Welcome to episode 241 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
filmmaking
from indie film to studio films and
everything in between.
How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to
fuck them up.
In a very humble opinion. I am Joel Zolderson, a writer, director and producer, and you are?
I'm Lucinda Rhodes Sacra, owner of Picture Perfect and independent film producer.
Woohoo! Today we are talking with the fantastic producer, but now mainly director, Alex Neuer, and his amazing indie film, Sound of Violence, which was not only a hit at Fright Fest, but is out now on Blu-ray and available on digital around the world. It's ace. Check it out. Lucinda, what did we talk about on this week's episode? What are our lovely fans and listeners, some of them aren't fans, listeners going to learn from this week's episode?
So, Giles, we talked about Clubhouse of Horror and how he is a judge, the importance of networking on Clubhouse in general, and the mental health in film.
We also talked about appreciating your crew, what do you do with overtime, and how he made his short film Conductor to prove he could direct.
We also spoke about the importance of a one-line pitch and directing techniques.
We also talk about why nerves are good on set and why you shouldn't panic, and what was his biggest learning curve? We also discussed selling the film, why you shouldn't be a dick, and why you need a good lawyer. Oh my gosh, it's a great episode. Myself and Lucinda, we are in echoey rooms right now, but we are on two different productions, different sides of the UK, and making them. So forgive us for the bad sound, but... do you know what I mean? We're making movies.
Hey, we're making movies. I knew you were going to say that.
Making movies. How's it going?
It's good. How are you doing, Giles, over there in Grimsby?
In Grimsby? It's good. Third week in now. The crew have all got used to each other now. That's, you know, how people move, how they roll. When it all starts
getting
gelling.
Getting into their groove.
They're getting into the groove. We're moving into nights this week, which if you don't know, it means you're shooting through the night. We've just had a little jiggery poker room. We might do some days this week as well, so splits. But that's fun. That's difficult. But so far, so good. And do you know what we did today, Lucinda?
What did we do today, Giles?
We put up a little screen and we put some images, footage from the film so all the cast and crew could see it when they came in, so they could see how what a good film they're making so far.
Amazing. And guess what else we did today, Giles?
What else did we do today, Lucinda?
We may have locked somebody very exciting to the film, Three Day Millionaire.
Basically, myself and Lucinda are producing Three Day Millionaire at the moment, and as always with these things, casting can take its time, but we knew that if we put this character towards the end of the film, once we got going, we could maybe get the name we wanted, and Lucinda might be just saying now, live on the air, that we might have that person, because I don't know.
No, I can't say that now.
No, you can't. You can't.
We gotta wait for the announcements.
Yeah, the announcements. And yours. So, like I say, you're doing two at the same time, which is super, super exciting, but also super,
super,
super
stressful.
Stressful,
Giles.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine.
Honestly, I don't think I'm gonna do it again, she says.
I don't think you should, he says.
No, but it's great. It's great. It really is. I sat actually last week. I had two iPads going, and I was holding a phone. Mm-hmm. And on the right-hand side iPad, I was in one HOD meeting with you, and I didn't put silent on. And then on the left-hand side, I was in another HOD meeting. And at one point, I didn't know who I was talking to or what I was answering. Mm-hmm. So that was great fun.
I remember having to keep muting you. I was like, she's in another conversation. She's forgotten to mute herself. I'm going to mute her now.
I think you'd just like to do that in general, wouldn't you?
Just do, I could do it now.
Don't do that to me. Oh, hi there.
Errol's
joined us. Is that
your
production designer?
It's production designer, Errol Jark.
Hey, Errol Jark.
Errol also just was part of Walls of War, which Giles and I wrapped in June.
Gosh, oh my God, it's not that long ago.
No, so we went from Walls of War straight on to Three-Day Millionaire.
We're going to fill you in on all our marvellous escapades.
Antics
coming up, but that was just a little insight for you. It's madness. It's full on when you're shooting. I can't even believe we're still doing the podcast, but we are. So myself and Lucinda managed to find time yesterday to sit down with Alex and his film Sound of Violence. Honestly, I love this film. I think it's brilliant. And it's a testament to what you can do on an indie film and get it out there and be really successful. So thank you so much for listening. Do keep supporting us and do tell all your pals about this podcast, because that's how we grow. And if you want to go on Patreon, then go on Patreon and support us even more, because there's even better stuff on there. Isn't there, Lucinda?
Oh, yeah. You've got to sign up for the extras.
So this is myself, Lucinda, chatting with the amazing Alex Noyer. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this absolute epic episode that Blessed Tobias V's has cut down into a sizable chunk for you. There'll be so much cool bonus stuff on the Patreon. But for now, thank you. Enjoy. Alex, it's an absolute joy to have you on. We've been trying to get you on since we started speaking on Clubhouse. When was that? About a year ago that Clubhouse, we became a big thing for us?
February, March.
I mean, it's an abstract. I mean, it was the pandemic and everything. I have no idea, you know, what day it is, how many months have passed. You know, have I aged? Am I the same? Who am I? I'm right now participating in the new Clubhouse horror anthology. So I'm reading something like 10 scripts a day at minimum. And I forget which one is good, which one is bad. I'm mixing stories and stuff, but it's actually just too much fun.
How do you do that, actually, Alex? Do you, because obviously people have processes of how is box information in their brains, like you have to file things in your brain, or I do. So if you're reading that many scripts a day, you've got all these different characters, all these different locations and plots and everything like that. How do you have a break in between scripts in order to put one script to bed and pick up the other one? Because surely they must go all in together.
Yeah, I mean, luckily they're very, very different. So that obviously helps. You have enough contrast between the stories, so that helps. But also we grade them, so we mark them as, you know, yes, maybe, and no, and we put a little bit of feedback. So that, just taking that moment to kind of anchor our opinion is good. And even though sometimes the opinion changes a little while back, because you have certain scripts that kind of stay with you, but I don't know, so far it's not been too bad. It's been pretty consistent as far as noticing the ones that I'm really keen on.
Because it must stand out. Certain scripts must stand out and you just go, ooh, this could be interesting.
Yes.
It must happen. Let's tell people what this is, because this was set up on Clubhouse. Now, people who don't know what Clubhouse is, it's kind of like this podcast, but you can ask to speak. So now you're listening, you can say, hey, can I speak? Can I ask a question? And Alex has run many rooms on there, and we ran a filmmakers podcast room, which is how we brought Alex into our team, and he became one of the filmmakers podcast hosts. We stopped doing it now just because we're all far too busy.
Because I ruined it.
Yeah. No, you were great on
there.
That was you. All right, yeah. Jed Shepherd, obviously, has been on this podcast before, and Alex and Sebastian Basel set up kind of, it was a Clubhouse room happening one night in one of the horror rooms. They said, hey, why don't we just make a load of shorts with the filmmakers that are here? And that was Symphony, which is the first one, which is now, I believe, ready and finished, the Clubhouse of Horror Anthology. And now you're a judge on the second one. Is that correct?
I'm a judge and producer on the second one, yeah. It's
great.
A lot of fun, because we only supported Symphony from afar. We talked a lot about it in the rooms and did everything we could to help Sebastian, you know, and I have a couple of projects as well in the starting blocks with Sebastian, so you know, we've always been in good communication. But that aside, now the new one, with the sort of the gravitas that the first one got and the attention, Sebastian decided to enlist a few filmmakers to come and judge which stories would be the right ones, because as well, now it's like there was a whole process of open submissions which closed a couple of weeks ago, and we got over 500 scripts to consider.
Wow.
And there are 10 that will make the anthology, And two of those 10 will be turned into features.
Oh, how cool is
Amazing.
That? And who? And Sebastian and his company are funding this. Is this correct?
Yes. I mean, we are. Screen Anthology is behind it, for sure.
Oh, great.
So Screen Anthology, Sebastian's company, are the ones putting this together. But they are... we've received a tremendous amount of interest from various new partners. So we'll see exactly who are all the producing entities at the end. Meanwhile, we have a really fun team. You mentioned Jed and Seb, but there's also Josh Stolberg of...
of course.
Who Soul wrote fame. Soul and up to Spiral. Mm-hmm. And we have Dave McInerney, who is a talent manager. And then Uncle Creepy himself, Steve Barton, who is the original founder of Dread Central. And also, you know, a very, very prominent figure in the horror world. So it's a lot of fun to be reading all those stuff, and we're just like, and we're disagreeing on everything.
I can imagine, because you all like different kinds of horror. You know, the host Jed's film is so different to Sound of Violence, your film, you know, it's massive difference. Do you know who the writers are, or is it kind of, that's good?
That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're reading everything anonymously because we know many contributors from our clubhouse. Yeah. Are sending stuff in, and it would not be right if we saw a mate, you know, their name on the script and everything. We just like, not that we would change our opinion, because we are, you know, we know what is a good story.
It can influence you. It can or not.
It puts you in a different, it puts you in a different mood. So we're reading everything anonymously, and that means that we give a chance to the story for what it is, and we have so much fun with it.
Does that mean they're directing them as well? How does it work in terms of your directors?
That's going to be up to them. They're going to have to crew up within Clubhouse. So mm-hmm. everybody has to come from Clubhouse. But
I love that.
The point is that some of them are just writers and have no intention to direct. Mm-hmm. Most of them, I'd say, will direct what they wrote, because many of them are written quite visually, and also you can see the intent. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, it's just like, it's going to be down to them to either go and find a director on Clubhouse to come on board. They're going to have, you know, they all have the same budget, they're all going to have the same things, and it's going to be up to them to kind of decide how they're going to bring it home. Obviously, we're going to help them. We're going to give them, going to mentor them and supervise the production. I know that Screen Anthology is going to provide a lot of line production support to mm-hmm. make sure that the budgets are not, you know, they're not on day two out of money and then panicking.
Totally. It's so important that as well, because it can happen if it's a first time filmmaker or whatever, and suddenly it's like, oh, I just forgot to budget for that, or I forgot to do that.
And also, the stories are written without any budget in mind. They don't know what they're going to have. So we've had stories which are like, okay, this is going to cost, like, this is a huge, enormous setup. It's like, we're like, and some of them are very sort of low key, but either way, there's just always, we're going to mentor them. The same thing is like when they're going to go through the various stages. Very rarely are scripts perfect, but we can just tell them, okay, here's your challenge for the next, to go into the next round, is that bring this on. It, you know, we're going to give them notes.
It's for you to see the potential in the writer and give guidance.
And it's crazy because you have a situation where you have absolutely incredibly talented writers, mm-hmm. where we're just going to help them with story points. And then you have some which clearly never wrote a script before, but that's okay because their stories are like awesome. So we're like, okay, here you go. We're going to help you shape it so that it works. And, you know, we narrowed it down to only to 7 to 10 pages. That in itself is a challenge because it's a short, you know, as we say a lot, the From Short to Feature room every Monday. And we always say you value each page, like each minute on screen, as if you didn't deserve it, because you got to justify, you know, in a short format, you have to justify that minute. So if you're giving us 7 to 10 pages, so 7 to 10 minutes, roughly, shorts, it's a challenge in itself because it's hard to make 7 minutes matter without waffling, without unnecessary descriptions and stuff. You got to keep the flow for 7 to 10 pages. That's not easy.
Well, it's like when Giles and I, when we ask our writers to put that into a synopsis, some of them freak out. They're like, mm-hmm. I can't do that, because it's really hard to get it into, you know, a synopsis for the back of a DVD or what have you. So yeah, totally understand.
To make a short is really difficult. A beginning, middle and end for like an anthology where you need it potentially to have that beginning, middle and end. It's hard to sort of, and this might happen in the future. It's one of the hardest things to write a really good short. It's kind of easier to write a feature. It's not in many ways, but at least you know you've got time to develop the characters and story and the arcs. With a short, you've got to do it in, you've got to like the characters, you've got to involve them, and you have to have a beginning, middle, and end. That's really tough.
And you have to know what information you shouldn't spend time on. Mm. That's if it was short. You're never gonna cover everything. I always say, yes, you do need your short to be able to stand alone and feel like it starts and ends. Mm-hmm. But don't worry about the three act structure. Don't worry about too much exposition as far as like, you're not going to solve everything. Leave them wanting more. That's the, mm-hmm. that's the quality shorts work. I mean, you know, with Conductor, the short that inspired Sound of Violence, mm-hmm. I give very little context. We just arrive in this mall and we see a cup with the name Alexis. That's okay. I've introduced a character. And then everything is like quite elusive. And in fact, I'm putting the focus on the situation, which has nothing to do with the main character. And the main character is very elusive. Mm-hmm. And then I just blows things up to shock. But the reason why my short worked was because I stripped away a lot of unnecessary explanation. When I'm taking somebody for essentially a 5-6 minute journey. Mm. And the same thing can be said of Jed's short Salt. It's focused on its purpose. Okay. How do you protect yourself from that demon? You put a salt circle. That's the one thing you want your audience to be left with. So in several of the rooms leading up to the project on Clubhouse, we explained, focus on what the main purpose of your story is. What is the main concept? The one idea that you want people to remember, and don't crowd it with unnecessary stuff that you don't have room for. Because then you're going to confuse them. And we read script like that, which have a great little golden thread in between, but it's stacked on with long descriptions of things that don't matter. Mm. And so anyway, the point is with the art of the short is that it's not about saying everything. It's about saying what you feel is necessary in a short time. Make sure that it feels as short as it is, if not shorter, mm-hmm. and then leave people wanting more. That's the great thing. That's the fun.
I love that. And I think that people should take that into any kind of film writing that they do, especially in shorts is like that. But certainly in features too, you know, it stop being waffly. Stop. What are you trying to say? What's the important bits of these stories? And especially in shorts. I remember my first shorts, I really wanted to get the beginning, middle and end. And it took all my brain power to try and get it. And I did and whatever. And then other shorts I made that I didn't need to have an ending. It was just, I want to tell this story and it could go on. It could be a feature. So I think you do whatever works for you to hone your craft, because that's what it's all about. And this Clubhouse anthology, what a brilliant way to get writers to think about it and actually think about what they're writing. And I think it's a brilliant thing you're doing. And I think, for those of people who weren't on Clubhouse and missed out, there'll be more of this.
We hope so.
You know, yeah. So join the Clubhouse rooms, join Alex's rooms with Jed Shepherd, the House of Horror Nights, Clubhouse of Horror Nights. You know, things happen on these places and you've got to be in it to win it. You've got to be involved.
During the pandemic, you know, it was so hard for filmmakers to network, mm-hmm. right? Yep. We didn't have film markets. We didn't have, so, you know, all of us, we have done things where we're missing perhaps people we know and the sort of interaction, whether it is the American film market here or traveling, you know, Cannes and so on. For emerging filmmakers, not to get that first experience of a film market at this critical point in their career is insane. Mm. So this is where Clubhouse became this really interesting platform where people interacted and talked to people they would have maybe not even had a chance to talk to in a film market. And the first time we did the short to feature room, it was, you know, so that's the one we run on Mondays. This young filmmaker came up and we always say no pitching. Nobody's allowed to pitch because it's just...
A lot of rooms do that, I think.
It's because it's bad for it to put your IP out there and you have no protection. You don't know who's listening. It's a mess. Plus, it's not really why we're here. We're not here to pick up projects. But so this kid was his kid. He's not his kid, actually. This dude is a.
We're old now, Alex. We're allowed to say kid, but we're
young. I'm in my 40s, and I'm calling everybody kid.
Hey, just speak for yourself, bro.
Yeah. He brought up an issue. He had a short ready to go, mm-hmm. and essentially he had all his funding in place, bar $1,000. And I had a bunch of producers on the stage, including Sebastian Bazil and another one called Sean. And they looked at his Instagram, which had good pictures of what he's shooting, because it turns out the guy was a DP, so the work looked really slick. And the guy said that he had a short going, everything, and he just needed $1,000 more. Two people up, Sebastian and Sean, went up 500 each we're in.
Yeah.
And apparently the short is amazing, and we're due to see it soon. But this is the point. Is like, where does that happen in film market? That like instant like that?
No, it doesn't.
And that grew into then Sebastian recruiting writers for the first anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he was putting it out there. They had a room, a late room that was not one of ours. A late room and with some of the writers, and all of a sudden he had all their scripts. Within like 24, 48 hours, he had enough script to make an anthology, and he just decided to do it. This is what I love about Sebastian. Sebastian is a real action person, and he represents the best of this industry has to offer, because he's a genuine indie filmmaker and supports indie filmmakers like very few out there.
No, but also on that, the thing with Clubhouse is you can then speak to people like Sebastian, like you say, like myself, like Alex, like Jed Shepherd, who are there being very open and saying, here we are, Uncle Creepy, another one. And also Josh Stolberg as well. You know, and I think that's what's amazing about that platform. If you have got something about you and you can speak well and you care about this industry and you have ideas, then people will take you on board. And this is what's happened.
Because they're joining a conversation. They're joining a conversation. And so they're not here again because we say no pitching. You're not coming up here to be noticed because of something you have going. You're coming here to have a conversation. In the short to feature, we've had talks of publicity. We have talks about marketing, production, pre-production, post-production. We talked about mental health on set. We talked about
that's a good one.
It was an incredible conversation.
Yeah, that's really important, actually.
It's hugely important.
We're gonna have another one of those actually in the coming weeks.
The mental health we're talking about in filmmaking is so important, and I think I've talked to you about this, Lucinda, as well, about getting a therapist on set. And actually having, especially with actors going through hard times, especially if you're doing a horror where you are mentally breaking down, you are seeing people, you are, you know, killing someone on film.
Well, not just actors.
No, crew as well. Yeah. I think it's vital. I think it should be something that moves forward. And my missus is a psychodynamic psychotherapist. And a couple of people have come to me knowing I'm a filmmaker who are therapists and said, hey, would this be something that would work in the filmmaking world? And I've gone, yes, we've got to find the budget for it. We've got to find that little space. But it's similar to a movement specialist or a fight director or a intimacy coordinator now. Yeah. You know, you need these things. So why aren't we protecting our cast and crew more?
I mean, actually, this is why the looming strike is about here.
Is it? In America?
Because there's a lack of support about working hours, about pay rates and stuff. I mean, I don't mean to blow my own trumpet, but we take really, really good care of our crews because, you know, maybe because I've been a producer for so long that just when we had those back-breaking small production and we know that everybody's on, you know, especially with shorts is a good way to really appreciate your crew because you know that you don't have the means to put everything together and everybody's doing you a favor by being on board.
Totally.
But then you it's the way you treat them that's going to decide whether or not they are on board with you. And, you know, here what they're saying is like a lot of the productions are, you know, pushing too far the demand of their crew and certainly not rewarding them enough. So it's an important thing. And it's just like the looming strike is going to, it looks like it's going to happen. And frankly, fair enough.
Totally.
It's a very important issue. And even when we run non-union crew, we treat them like their family because, you know, the set is a living organism.
Yeah, totally. Because you want your crew to want to work for you and with you.
And to represent your film. When it comes out, you want everybody who's worked on it to be shouting it on the rooftops.
Totally. I'm proud of it. Of course you do. But then when you're in the middle of it and you do have those problems and issues, it can be really overwhelming all around. And that's why I think having someone on set can really help that and bridge that. So you're not holding it all in or you're bitching and moaning to someone else about it. You're actually talking to someone who understands and listens, basically.
The thing we're talking about in production, for instance, I was talking with my production manager the other day, and I think, Giles, you might have been on that conversation as well. Mm. As producers and writers and directors and all those HODs, but really the producers and production managers, all you're doing every day is giving, giving, giving and solving problems to other people, but you need to be replenished.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard if there's nobody, everybody's coming to you with the problems and you're like, where do I go?
Yeah.
Apart from your spouses.
Yeah.
Which is not always good.
Let's say that in each production, we have a little reserve, that little reserve of energy we have for when inevitably something is going to go wrong. Right. And if we keep blowing up that energy on stuff that we can absolutely deal with with a cool head and straightforwardly, we start expending that little bit of energy that you need, like your contingency energy, if you will.
Yeah.
And so, and the only way we keep that is by having a real good grasp of our team, of our communication. We, you know, this is again where the first AD's role is so important, and it just becomes the oldest sort of the first AD and the line producers are going to have to themselves make sure that that little reserve contingency energy is saved, as far as like, so everybody's like, we don't unnecessarily go too long, we don't unnecessarily, you know, rush hours of lunch or anything. We make everything happen as they can, even if once in a while we always feel like, especially on the creative side, we're like, ah, what if we could take an extra take, and everything is, you know what, it's better to just now let everybody take a beat, then we'll be back, and either we do that take or that moment passes. And I think it's for Sound of Violence, we shot the movie in 20 days, which is ridiculous. But we pretty much, I think we ran over time maybe twice.
How long did you go over during that time?
Like, I think it was like an hour and a half.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that's...
Yeah. Both Charles and I would,
ooh. Because we do 5 or 10 and that's pushing it. So an hour and a half, how did you deal with that? Because obviously that's crew, that's actors.
It was an hour and a half on one day because essentially we had a major prop breakdown. So we just had to... So we paid everybody the extra. And we obviously sent home whoever was not needed. We really went bare bones on that extra hour, and that's it.
Yeah, because as going back to what Giles said, yeah, he means 5 or 10 minutes, not 5 or 10 hours.
Yeah, 5 or 10 minutes, I'm already going, no, I don't like it, don't like it. Yeah, because we've got to respect your crew, you have to. And you think, you know, especially the directors and writers and producers who are listening, no one, they care about your film, of course, but you really care. And you have that, if we just have this extra shot now, and I know we're going to go over by 10 minutes, it's never 10, but if you go, yeah, but we get the shot. And you go, yeah, but you've got to think about the mentality and the well-being of your crew, and that's not what they signed up for.
But again, if you think about it, if productions run over in days. And you know, the fact that at the end we had one day at an hour and a half, and I think one day we were late, the same like 10 minutes, I think. So it's like, it was not tragic, and nor was it, everybody was compensated for the extra. You know, we obviously limit the crew that was only necessary. Nobody was, and we asked, are you okay to stay that extra hour? Because we communicate with our crew.
You've got to.
It seems crazy to think that like some people don't. There's like, oh no, everybody's just do my bidding. We said, well, you know, it's, and we had a healthy energy on set because we talked.
And that's it. That is the good thing. But it can get tricky in those situations, it really can. People are tired and things do go wrong. And like you say, as long as you talk to your crew and say, look, this is happening, do you mind? I mean, we can make it up to you in other ways. It can work. But on an indie film, it's really tricky because you don't have that extra money to necessarily pay overtime. You've budgeted for what you've got, and it can be, especially really low budget, you're asking favors anyway, you know. It's really tough.
Yeah, but we had a buffer. We had a buffer at the beginning of the production when we budgeted for extra time. Like, it's not much. You have this little bit that you hope not to spend because it's something that you're taking out for something else.
Contingency, but yeah.
Your contingency is there. And so it's necessary. And we had to use it for things like, you know, you use it for breakdowns or for extra time. And it's like, you know, we used it. We stayed on, but we were in budget, never over budget. And this is why, you know, that strike here, that's all they're asking. It's just like, okay. Because there's a rule here about, you know, if you go over, that means you have to start later the next day.
Yeah, that's the problem as well. Turnaround time.
So luckily, the day of delay was before day off. So we were good on that. But again, it's only an hour and a half, but it's an hour and a half. And especially when we know how physically exhausting it is to be any hour on set. Anyway, it went well, and we are absolutely standing by the safety and well-being of our crews. And it's sad when we hear some of the stories that have been coming out. You know, we read them and we're like, oh my God, this is scary. I think this is important too, that this conversation is very much live right now, especially here in the US and in the UK, because I mean, I started my production company and career in the UK. It's less of a union issue. It's more of a people issue. People are making kind of their own, you know, the regulation is not as stringent as here, but at the same time, the people have absolutely, they will do and they will push your production as far as they can if you show them respect.
It's getting tougher in the UK, funny enough, and rightly so. People need to be looked after and compensated, as you know, we've been talking about. So it's more lenient than over there. Again, I get that. But we are getting stricter, especially on the shoots that we're on now. I said to somebody, are you okay to go over by 2 or 3 minutes? And they said that would be an hour of overtime. And that was just one person out of the crew of like 50, because, you know, and we're treating them very well, mm-hmm. kindness and all the things. So it is getting stricter, totally 100%. But can I take it right back to the beginning of Sound of Violence? Because one, I love the title. I love the Thank title. You. I'm a big thriller fan. So let's, you know, go all the way back, because the three of us obviously love a chat, and we're going off and discussing all different things. So let's go back and get rid of football and Damn. Just start with, how did Sound of Violence come about? Why the title? How was this born? Because, yeah, we want to know.
It's a real sum of my parts, in the sense that, like, I've been a producer now for 17 years, but for the bulk of it, I was a producer of documentaries. Mm-hmm. And it culminated with a music documentary called 808, which is about the TR-808 drum machine. The documentary 808, where we have people like the Beastie Boys, Pharrell Williams, Phil Collins. I mean, it took 5 years of my life, essentially. And it was really the culmination of my documentary producing career. It's the biggest music documentary I've ever produced, and definitely one of the biggest music documentary of the last 10 years, if I can say so.
Can I ask you on that, what the writer Luke Bainbridge,
yeah,
is he English?
Yeah,
I know him. Right, okay,
good. Oh, you know everyone, Joe. Yeah.
He plays football with me.
I mean, that whole project was born out of the UK. We were very much UK-based when we were doing that. But anyway, the film kind of, yeah, took over my life and was the reason I moved to the US as well. It was everything was drum machine related after that for me. It was a drum machine obsession. But I was exhausted as far as documentaries were concerned. I couldn't see myself necessarily producing another massive music one like that. And my wife turned around and said, you know, maybe it's time for you to finally switch to your all-time love, which is horror. Mm-hmm. And so I started to look into it, to get a couple of projects going in terms of writing them. And I was working on a feature that was supposed to be my directorial debut, but then got delayed. So instead, I took the family on a little break. And I was reminiscing about 808, and there came a light bulb that after being drum machine obsessed for so long, I really need to kill somebody with a drum machine.
And
literally.
Yeah. And in the film, obviously.
Obviously. I mean, they haven't found the bodies.
there's no proof.
So that's where Conductor was born. The short film Conductor was born out of this idea. It was also because I was switching seat from producer to director. So I felt that it might help the project that I was pushing at the time. And it was a moment for me to just use something I knew very well. And that's another advice we give often to short film writers: use something you really care about, that you know.
Yes.
And so I made the short, and the short was supposed to just be that, just a short to prove to myself as much as to everybody else that I could direct and to get going. And the short toured festivals and did really well. We won a bunch of awards. A lot of interest came about my elusive main character, Alexis. Even though the short was not meant to be, I had obviously thought about her story as a whole. That's how I could brief my actors with context and backstories and such. Mm-hmm. So I initially thought about writing her backstory as a short. And then when I started writing, it expanded, and I started to come up with ideas of her murderous journey. So I wrote the feature, and then very quickly I managed to raise, you know, about a third of the budget as well. So things were really organically happening for that.
This intermission was brought to you by Massive. Hey, Robbie.
Hey, Giles.
As we all know, Robbie has left us and joined a huge movie studio. There, his horrible boss has tasked him with developing movie pitches. So, what have you got for us this week?
It's a little bit different. We're doing a UK production for BBC4. Ooh. And it's Ralph Fiennes. Ooh. And he wants to make a documentary on socks.
Wow.
Now, this is not something that most people know. Ralph Fiennes is mad on socks. This is 100% true. He's crazy about socks. He wants to make a documentary. Giles, how do we punch this up? How do we polish it?
Wow, you've come to the right person. How about Ralph Fiennes travels around with 4 various socks that all talk to him
I mean, that's just a wonderful idea. I can't see it backfiring in any way. So,
no.
Yeah, I mean, what documentaries need is inanimate objects that talk, you know, like Muppet-type characters. That's what we want.
Totally. And they've all got different personalities. You can have a hiking daddy sock.
Of course,
you can have
a
baby sock. And then you can have stockings that keep falling down.
Well, that's not appropriate for BBC Four Jars. Come on now.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
But in the dock, they can explore the woven looms that make socks with Rafe, you know, like a little gang following him around.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I think that's a proof. That's all we need, right? I mean,
This is an amazing idea, Robbie. I forget Sprout Boy. I want royalties on this one.
Let's sock it to them.
We live in turbulent times right now. Fuel shortage. And now I've just heard that the price of socks has gone down.
No.
It looks like the sock market is crashing. Good luck. See you at the Oscars.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks again.
All this the world well knows, yet none knows well that leads men to this hell.
If you have a massive movie idea or any large files, transfer them with Massive, spelled M-A-S-I-V. Sending a large file with Massive is as easy as sending an email. Sign up for Massive today using massive.io/filmmakerspod and get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer.
Well, let's talk about that just before, because obviously people are all going, wait, how did you do that? Because finding funding for anything is really difficult, let alone film, even though actually it's a safer place to invest your money than some places. But how did you said that I'd already managed to raise some of the money. How at that point had you done it when you just made a short? Obviously, you've made lots of great docs. You were well established in that field. You weren't coming at it cold. But at the same time, this is different. This isn't doc. This is a feature, live action. How did you manage to raise that money?
Well, I mean, it was down to the script. First draft of the script I wrote, it really came out of me very organically. And it was in January 2019. And so I started to reach out to private investors who I had interacted with before. And I very straightforwardly said, this is, the short is, it ended up being a proof of concept. It's doing well. It's picking up attention in awards. Everybody who's reviewing it is screaming about it. So we're really onto something. And then I used my, you know, I mean, I started my company in 2004 in London, you know, and we were in commercials for a long time.
Yeah.
And so all I did was pitching. That's all I did. So I used some of that. And I know that technically the director should not be the one raising finance. But you know what? That's what I do.
However you get it raised, it doesn't matter if it's the director, the production designer, the producers. As long as it gets raised and you can make such a wonderful thing, yeah, it doesn't matter who raised it.
So I got you know, private investors to commit to it. And that got us started. And then, by the time it was Cannes in 2019, I had the script, which was at the time still called Conductor. It was a much more of a horror movie than it was a thriller. And I had already a sense that actually I needed to go away from horror and more towards a thriller, albeit a horror thriller, but still. With that in mind, I still, and this is another advice I give a lot, is that make sure that you have a one sentence to pitch your movie. If you can pitch your movie in one sentence, you'll get quick yes, no's, or a quick sense of interest or not. And okay. I went around Cannes with simply the sentence, story of a killer who makes music through murder. That's all. That got me a producers network breakfast. I got more follow-up meetings out of that just by giving them that pitch. And it was, that's how it rolled. And it just really kind of escalated organically. And you know, we shot the movie in October, November 2019. So if you think about it, first draft January, shooting the movie October, November, that's a movie minute. That's where... you know, I was very proud of that idea.
But let's talk about making it then, because, you know, this is your, you can go directorial debut here. I definitely think so. Even though you've produced movies, it is directorial debut.
And
it is beautiful film. It's stunning. I can see why it's done so well, especially in the UK. The poster itself is cool. It says what the film is, and you dive into this girl's world, who is brilliantly played by Jasmine Savoy Brown, by the way, who plays your lead.
I love her.
She's great. And you love working with her, which is great. So let's talk about your directing process here. And how you managed to, you know, work on set as a first
timer, if you like, and that's being mean because you're not, but people want to know, well, how did you do it?
Well, first of all, I had to kind of also unlearn a few things. You're so used to being on set as a producer that I had to harness myself to just focus on the storytelling and the performances. And this is where I must give massive credit to Hannu Aukia, my producing partner, who's the lead producer on this, because he is a Finn, meaning that he speaks his mind bluntly and with no emotions. So once in a while, you know, he would put me back in my place saying, you know, shut up, go focus on that. And I'm like, that's great, thank you. And also my line producer, Dave Zhao, who one day on set said, just so that you know, if anything goes wrong, you'll be the last one to know.
Yeah, interesting. Lucinda said the same to me on Wolves of War. She went, can you stop trying to produce? Shut up. Yeah, this is my job. Shut up, go away.
Well, if you have so many hats, it's really hard when you jump into a movie and you're doing the different job that you did from the last movie. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to then go, okay, well, I'm just going to focus on directing this rather than thinking about the budget or how's the unit move going. Don't worry about that. You know, make the movie.
That's a relief to feel that actually once in a while it's like, oh, I don't have to worry about that. That's great. But, you know, the interesting thing is as well, and, you know, again, testament to the rest of the crew, Daphne, my cinematographer, because, you know, I'm not a director who's going to operate. I'm purely focused on directing. I'm not touching the camera. We had such a good rapport planning the look of this film to be what it is, that there was a sense of it helped us. You know, really, for the lighting setup, when I didn't like something, it was like I didn't have to go and explain it too much. I was like, okay, let's just switch that. It's like, and we had a lot of visual references and things that we had talked about early on. So all that pre-work really paid off to be prepared and arriving on set and really feeling like we already read each other's mind. So that was helpful. And then into the process, you start, it feels good to feel your nerves. I must say that was like, I love the idea of being a rookie again because it's exhilarating. And I fell down on Conductor big time, just too hastily shouting cut or too, you know, something, mistakes like that you just like you're so eager to do so you mess up basic things.
Do you think nerves helps you? I don't know if get it right is the right word, but sometimes I've heard actors say the nerves help you give a better performance, so it's not so laid back, for instance, and it's like yeah I know what I'm doing, it's fine, but the nerves can enhance sometimes. Is that something that works for you?
Only the fool feel no nerves. Like it just like it's nice. It's important to, if you're not nervous, you're not prepared, you're not ready. Because if you're walk on set and you're like, this is easy, that means that one, you don't care enough, two, you're not putting pressure on yourself, and three, you will be caught out on something because there's no way you can have this. There's too many things, too many moving parts to just have a, you know, to not feel stressed about. I'm not saying that people should panic. That's a very big difference. I don't want people, nobody should panic on set. This is like one of those things. It's like panicking around dynamite.
Especially if you're the lead, you're either directing or producing and you're running around with your head going, I don't know, okay, good of it. Oh my God, no.
Shouting at people.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
If you're nervous internally, it's great. It's, yeah, you're right. Don't panic outside so everyone can see it.
I felt everything. I felt nervous the first day I met Jasmine. I felt nervous, you know, when everything was a go. My first meeting with Daphne. I mean, aside of the, no, not the first, but the first meeting doing Shortlist and such. I felt nervous. I was like, you know, it's like, we talk about imposter syndrome. We talked about it a lot on your filmmaker's room. No matter how experienced you are, how many times you've been on set, the first time directing a feature, you feel like everybody's going to find out that I have no fucking idea what I'm doing.
100% agree with that.
And it's, you are
frightening.
You are the least qualified person on the set.
Yeah, usually. DP's done about 16 jobs that week. You know what I mean? Actors have done a load. Crew have done a load. And you're literally, you've never made a movie.
You feel like a fraud, can't you?
You feel like a fraud when people go, where do you want the camera?
Everybody's looking at you saying, why are you doing this? Why is it you?
And there will be people on set who do that. There's people who want to be directors and they'll be looking going, why you? Why did this happen? And because you put the work in, you put the graft in, you wrote the story, you found the money. In your case, 100% deserve to be there. But you can see why people would be pissed off and angry with it. Why not me? Well, you got fucking work for it, dude. But in your case, how amazing. But it is fun and you can be nervous. And it's great that we talk about this kind of stuff.
It's good to be nervous. It feels good because this is the luck we have in this job. Mm. You do realize there's so many jobs that are not fun. They're not exhilarating. We are in the most fun job. It's scary
sometimes.
Every day. It's
sometimes,
right?
I know. You know, producing is like riding a bike, except the bike is on fire. You're on fire and you're in hell. Yeah. But everything is just like, it's so much. My wife was telling me that she had never seen me so happy. And like coming back from the set, exhausted, like literally just like crumbling down into bed. And she said, yeah, but you looked so happy. You had a smile on your face. And that's how it felt. I gave my all every day. Every day, I wanted everybody on set to believe in me and to believe in the story. Mm. And I just did that every day. And I talked, and I'm not talking about like, you know, my DP and producing team. I'm talking everybody. You know, for everybody. I wanted the crafties to be happy. I wanted my safety to be happy. I want everybody to be like.
That's leadership qualities, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so much fun.
You're leading the team
as well. You have those moments that define your direction, and I think those moments are the moment where, for example, as I said, like my producing partner, he has a lot of experience. He's also a director himself, and when we shot the short, there was a scene that we needed to shoot, and we needed intensity. That was like really, really like from the character that Michael McLean was playing. And I had to take him there to like, you know, mentally to, he had to essentially scream of terror, but at like something like, you know, it really comes from within. And when it comes out, it needs to give you shivers, right? Yeah. And he had a few takes and he was just not hitting. And, you know, I'm very emotional. So I just went to him and I went there with him. I said, like, you need to really go into a moment that you don't want to go to because you got to think where, how far and dark you can go because this is your world is collapsing in front of you. Yes. And then in front of him, I roared. I showed him like my scream.
Wow.
And the whole set went silent. Mm. So that was on the short. And then right after he looked at me, and he just exploded. And the scene was like, I gasped and I couldn't even speak. I was so happy for him and everything. But it was just a moment where really I felt, as a director, I felt, okay, that connection was awesome.
And isn't that great when you can get that with your actors? And every actor is different.
Very different.
There's not one way to direct a movie. There is 28 that day, you know, whether it's talking to DP, like say talking to craft services, if you want to do that, but talking to your actors and how different they are. Every single one of them wants to be talk to differently, depending on how they're brought up, depending what they're going through, depending what character they are. And that's something you hardly ever gets taught. And there's not something that's film school. You never hear that. Dealing with actors and how you get a performance when you're not happy is really tough.
You're not going to learn that at film school. I mean, no matter what they tell you, I mean, I didn't go to film school for it, so
me neither. So actually, maybe they do, but you know, hey.
No, I mean, listen, this is the part which depends. Like with the actors on Sound of Violence, especially with Jasmine, we, from the first meeting onwards, I collaborated because several things. First of all, shooting a thriller from the perspective of the killer is something which demands a performance of a level that is not just a question of a looming killer that we don't see. So that was already, so I knew that the exposition onto Alexis was going to be, and so this is where the talent of Jasmine is needed, because that's the only way to be able to push this. And her take, in our first meeting, her take on the characters and everything, I knew that she understood the character great, and I felt like I had met Alexis. So that was very helpful. But then also remembering that as well, I wrote the story of a queer Black woman. I have no right to project any assumptions onto that. I need to make sure that we deliver this authentically. So Jasmine being a queer Black woman obviously is allowed me to have somebody meet me halfway and make sure that this character was represented authentically, and she was very happy that there was no cliches in the script and stuff. So we really reviewed this together. And then the final part is English is not my first language.
Yeah.
So I needed the dialogues to be tweaked throughout, not to change what she was saying, but actually to make sure that it sounded more natural. And in fact, that cooperation went on with Lily Simmons and James Jagger.
Amazing cast.
To make sure that all those lines were just like, and I, at the end of those exhausting days, they would be up for, like I would be, chit-chatting about the lines and making sure we could tweak a couple of things to make sure they sounded better. So that was fantastic. And that was really, I just didn't want to be on this movie that demanded performances. I could not be just pointing fingers and demanding that you just do what I say.
Yeah.
There is an overall performance that of course is on me, but as far as the authenticity of the relationship between the actors and the characters, this is where from pre-production, from the first early days that I worked with the actors all the way to the end, I made sure that was a collaboration. And that also, going back to your question about being a first-time director, that steadied me massively, knowing that my cast had my back.
Yeah. Yep.
And they were meeting me. Like, as I said, I wrote this script with an open mind because of all the things that I didn't want to project, but also because I felt that there was something is going to happen as we perform it. And they met me there. We elevated the experience, and we had several scenes of real intensity. The opening scene, the family scene, this young, amazing, force to be reckoned with, Camille Benge, who plays young Alexis.
Oh, God, yes.
She commandeered the set that day. and then we had Dana Wilson and Wes McGee, who play the mother and father, who also really matched this tension that we needed between the two of them to mount. And the whole, like, literally, there's that scene where he hits the table. After that take, the set was quiet. My focus pullers had tears running down, and everybody was just like, really, I was a mess at the end of this. And then I look over and I see Camille, nothing, like done. She had been really a catalyst for this moment of emotion, and she went there herself. And then she just trotted out happily after that. And she is incredible. I genuinely, like, I think Camille has a great, great future as an actress.
Isn't it amazing how actors can do that, and they can surprise you so much by being incredible.
At 10 years old.
Yeah, I had a couple on the dare who were just, they blew my mind with how intelligent they were as actors at that age. And you're just like, what? And it's amazing for us as directors, because we kind of take the credit for it, but that you go, oh, thank you. It's about casting, right? It's about, if you cast well at that age, whoa, if not, you're going to have a problem. But if you cast well, it's amazing.
And that's also, you know, the first meeting you have with them, and their parents are there. So you have that vibe as well.
So important, yes.
But overall, in actors' performance as well, I want to go back to Jasmine a little to just say there's two other things that Jasmine did that allowed me to really, again, as a director, as a feature debut for me as a director, she has a skill which few actors have, and that I respect so damn much because it allowed us to give option. She can act with her eyes. And that is something, I'm not just talking about having your eyes not betray you. I'm talking acting. Meaning that, for example, in the first murder, we started doing a technique that I love, which is a full silent take. So the whole thing happens.
Yep.
Not a single line. And she just gives all those moments with her eyes. And Jasmine is probably one of the best I've ever seen as far as acting with eyes. And that meant that when we did the silent take, they gave us great editing options.
Yes, of course.
Because you're first of all, you realize which line are really unnecessary.
And totally unnecessary. You don't need them. What was it there for? Yeah.
And then you realize that you can all of a sudden really, so you remove those lines and you're replaced by those moments with her eyes. And you're like, oh, you know, it gives you, I mean, you vibrate.
Do you know, that's a great technique, Alex. I love that idea. Usually it's because I don't have time, but again, you shot in 20 days, we shot the dare in 18, and it's the same, you know. And the fact that you did that, but actually you were clever enough to think about your editing options there and go, do you know what? If I don't need the line, if she says this without saying the line through her eyes, the audience understand what's happening, which most audiences do, you then don't need the line. Therefore, in the edit, you've got the option to not do it. And I love, that's great. Great advice for everyone listening. That's brilliant. Love that.
It saves you a lot of time. But well, actually, if you mention editing, one thing we did is instead of a traditional DIT and having dailies, we actually had our editor on set, and the editor was not only obviously processing the footage, but he was actually editing on while we were shooting. So we were organizing everything in a way that really gave us a sense of what coverage we were missing or what we were lacking, editing options and stuff, and really in real time. And Verti Verkajärvi really did an amazing job by doing that on set. It's not by no means editing anything that looks like a final product it's just organizing in a way that you're like, okay, we have options here. Where do we sit as far as coverage and such? And knowing when we can really move on all the time. And he was doing that while I was directing. So I could always tap in. And Hannu, who produced but also edited the film, kept an eye between that. And so, you know, if there was a moment where like, okay, we're concerned about coverage here. Okay, what do we need? What can we do? Mm-hmm. And it was very dynamic and it was very pleasant to work that way. And then, so when we did for example, the silent take, like from the first take, and that's like, I had way too much dialogue in there. Yep. Yeah. She was explaining herself too much. It was like a whole bunch of things. And we cut like most of it because of that, the silent take. We tested the silent take and it's just, and then we did a spoken take with less lines and it worked immediately better. And it's the thing is, it saves you time. It doesn't use time. It's really, really, sometimes when you're like, okay, should I do another take? Actually, no, let's change something. And in this case, it was like, let's remove all the lines. When you're lucky to work with a talent like Jasmine, it really means that the constant questioning that you have inside is in front of you, because she is we could bounce off each other even without speaking.
Oh, I love that. It's great when that happens. It really is with actors when you get those moments. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, Jasmine Savoy Brown, she's about to blow up in the latest Scream movie. She's also in so much telly, including The Leftovers and For the People and Lego Star Wars and Love.
Yellow Jacket's coming to Showtime. She has. I couldn't get her today if I tried.
No,
I
think. That's the thing, isn't it?
If I came with my directorial debut today and I asked her, no chance. Now, the good news is that we have such a good rapport that I'm hoping to work with her again at some point.
And that's the thing we try and strive to do, is get the actors when they're, especially in indie film, is they're just about to break out, right? You treat them well, they like working with you, and you go, please come and work with me on my next films, which is what's happened with me. It's been really nice to use the same cast over and over, who you're like, there's no way I'd normally get these people. But because they're mates now, because they like working with you, the agent's saying no, and they go, I want to do it anyway. I want to go and play. And that's the place you want to be in, right? As a filmmaker, it's great. What did you learn from working with your crew then that you would take forward to the next film? What was something that maybe something went wrong, that you maybe didn't do right, that you can give advice on?
That's a great question. You know what? I mean, fundamentally, the whole experience is anyway, again, in your shift of dynamic from producer to director, that in itself, you're you have to feel that everything is new in every relationship with all the position that you have on set. I was very lucky. Most things went well. Most things went really well because I, you know, I'm a communicator and I just tend to, we had moments and then, I set my expectations clearly. Mm-hmm. This is one thing which, since the short, people who have worked with me know something is that I know exactly what I want.
Good.
And I'm making that very clear to all of them. Yeah, the importance of that became very, very clear when things went slightly different from what I wanted, that I would not lose my mind and start screaming at people, because I didn't. Mm-hmm. I would be like, okay, listen, you know, and I knew the script by heart, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, here, this is what I'm describing here. We got to fix this because I need this to do this and this. And I could be, and it's interesting that the biggest learning curve is to be able to switch in a matter of minutes from, okay, performance, art, to about, like you're talking to five different departments in a matter of minutes with clear instructions to every single one of them. Mm-hmm. And you are not allowed to hesitate. You're making a decision here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's one thing which I'm not happy with, which is one piece of wardrobe on one actor that the actor is not, none of it was anyway peripheral, but it was just one thing which I cared about that I had written. And I, at the end of the movie, I regretted not standing for what I said about that piece of clothing.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that was like, yes. I was quite trivial about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't, it's not a bad thing, mm-hmm. but at the end I'm like, you know what? I missed it in every shot.
Right.
Yeah. And it annoys me that something like that, which I had specifically written in the script, was I kind of let go of. You have to let go of some things, of course. But that one thing, I was like, ah.
I wish I'd actually just said, no, guys, that's what I need. That's what's in there. Get that for me? Yeah, that's what I wanted. If it's not here, please, we'll wait. But it is that at the time, like you say, as a director, you have to make that decision. And as long as people are coming up and going, look, we lost this, but we've got this red top or we've got this pinky top, which one do you want? At least you've got options. The worst thing is when crew members come up and go, there's been a problem. And you go, what do you want me to do about it? I'm about to do another scene. You know, you have to come as a producer or as a crew member to the director with solutions. And I do ask that of my crew. Go with solutions. Don't go with Absolutely. Problems. But let's talk about selling the movie, because this is also a huge bit. People can go out there now with their iPhones and make a movie, and you can edit it on Movie Magic. But getting it out into the world is one of the hardest things. Getting the money and getting it out into the world. The two hardest things in filmmaking, I think. There's so many things that are hard, but they're the ones that matter, if you like. When Sound of Violence was now in post, did you already have an idea of what you were going to do with this film? Because the film has done really well. You know, there's no question about it. It has been talked about. Reviews have been brilliant across the board. There's always some dickhead. And it did brilliantly at Fright Fest when I met you in person for the first time, which was a delight. And
likewise.
Yeah. How did you have a strategy, I suppose, with a film like this from the off? Did you know who you were going to? Had you thought about it?
First of all, finding a sales agent is important. We opted to do something which is not always popular, but we took a sales agent for including our North American rights. Somebody who just like worldwide. Mm-hmm. And that was because we were not in a position to go and put it ourselves, selling it ourselves locally when we, you know, it was important to find the right partners on that. We knew that this was a film that needed to be taken on board by people who really fucking loved it. Sorry, I don't know if I'm swearing too much now.
You can fucking swear as much as you fucking want.
All right, well, they fucking loved it. No, and so we needed to find, that was important. I mean, and that's always a tip. I said, thinking about just getting a big sales agent, might not mean that your movie does better.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
It's actually, you need to have a sales agent who's going to go and die for your film. You know, really, I mean, that's exaggerating, but just to... They will fly the flag for you. They will really, they understand it. And we it came down to essentially three, four candidates.
You send it to them? Did you send screeners? How did you do it to get it to them?
I reached out because the people I knew and others reached out to us when we made our cast announcements.
They always do. That's when they come out, they come knocking.
they don't want to talk to you before you cast, but then when you announce a cast, and when we announced Jasmine and Lily, and then it was a process, and then we also had people who were really interested and didn't vibe with the film, with the end result. You know, and also the tricky thing is obviously we were in the middle of the pandemic, and it was a moment where there was a lot of uncertainty, and my movie was a risk because my movie is not, is it horror? Is it drama? Is it both? They don't like that. They want to be able to say, okay, this is going to be a bonkers slasher movie. No, no. It's like, this is, there's a lot of dimensions to this
film. It's a thinking man's thriller horror. Absolutely. A woman's.
I appreciate you saying that, but it means that it's not easy to sell. Because it's not straightforward. It doesn't. Exactly. You can't just box it.
No.
And we had actually, you know, people who were really, 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 really following the project all the way from Cannes 2019, who they came back and loved the film. Yep. Have no idea how to sell this. It hurts because you're like, but you love the film. Surely that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. But right now, when you're in indie horror with a market that is, who knows what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and it really became then a matter of having conversation, and then we opted for VMI because they were like, okay, no, we want this. We're going to
VMI worldwide.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And so, you know, it was down to a rapport, an idea that they're going to go and also take the risk that this movie is. It is a risky movie. I was not offended to be told by some of the interested big names. I won't name them here, but who really followed this. And there was a pretty good chance of being represented, but they came to us and they were like, we just don't know what it is. The pandemic made it so hard. Like that movie coming out pre-pandemic, we would have perhaps had more offers, but it doesn't matter. We were where we were. The pandemic allowed us to take more time to really get it right.
Got you.
And then the people that came on board are the people, they must be the right people because they're the ones who believed in it.
Mm-hmm. That is, I agree with
and
that.
That's the only rule. I mean, and then the fact that we ended up again in the way things were, because we were trying to push it to come out in 2020, but by the time we had something to show, it was late. It was imperfect. It was not the strategy was not lining up, and the vibe was really good about the film, but it was not ready yet, or people were kind of confused as to where it was. As soon as we hit the end of 2020, and we had a version with a little bit more of the synesthesia, the VFX shots, all those things a little bit more flourished. Then it was like all of a sudden things started to snowball. It was like, oh, now we know what it is. So we signed with VMI. Later on, it was a question of where we was going to premiere. And I had 808 premiere at South By. So obviously as an alum, I sent it there. And Jared, who now actually left at South By, but Jared Neese, who was a big, amazing champion of indie horror, emailed me on the 23rd of December, inviting my film to world premiere at South By.
Amazing.
I'm just getting emotional even speaking about it right now.
Did you do the deals as well, like with VMI? Were you doing the paperwork? Because obviously you produce movies in the past, you understand paperwork and distribution and sales. Were you sitting and doing it yourself?
As far as the deals with VMI?
Yes, deals with VMI.
Yeah, the deal with VMI was, obviously we had production council but I'm the signatory, yeah.
Yeah, so you went through all that deal. And it's hard. Doing that sort of stuff is difficult. It just is. You're scary because you think, what am I signing? Am I saying, you hear all these horror stories about distribution and being ripped off and all that stuff. And it can be frightening. There's a contract in front of you. It's, yay, they want our film. But actually, what is it that they're giving you back? What is it? And you have to know this stuff. It's really frightening.
This is why you need you need a good production counsel, a good lawyer.
Yeah.
Because it's like, and that's not just an idea of a lawyer, that just the hours they put on the contract and that's the billable time. It's the time, the non-billable time, the part where actually I had an amazing lawyer in the UK called Alexander Carter Silk. And he was like always telling me, some of this is hand-holding, meaning it's like, I'm here to just steer you in the right direction. That's why we all had like really fun conversation. And actually, many conversations with my counsel here, the same. It was like, we're just like, okay, what's your vibe with this? How do you feel and everything? It's aside of like the pure legal review of the paperwork. It was also to have somebody with who you can have that personal rapport and kind of like, and speak about your concerns.
Yeah. And it's so important. It really is. And you're with Gravitas Ventures in America. In the US. And they've just taken myself and Lucinda's film, Repeat. You might have noticed Lucinda has gone very quiet. She messaged. Yeah. got emergency. She's got to jump back on set. I wish she'd done it on the pod. That would have been much more fun rather than me saying it. But that's what's happened. She's still there. Her face is still there. Her picture's still there, but she's run off. But anyway, myself and Lucinda's one of the films we produced called Repeat. We just did a deal with Gravitas and, you know, I was doing that deal. And then again, it was me just ringing up, you know, emailing, going, hey, you've worked with my friends on this film. Matthew and Tory Butler Hart's film was with them recently, Infinitum Subject Unknown, and Ian Sharp's film was with them. So I was like, right, well, let's just email them. And they knew about me. And then suddenly it was in, cool, you're now not going in too cold. And I think that's what helps by networking in the indie film industry. And by doing a podcast like this or by going on Clubhouse, you do meet people who can help you in this industry, or at least you can say, I know them, their film was with them. And you can also email anyone in this industry and say, what was that distribution deal like? What did you learn? We'll all help each other. That's what this podcast is about. We're here to help.
That's indie filmmaking. I mean, if we don't help each other while being indie filmmakers, it's very obnoxious. I mean, it's like,
I love that.
It's one of those things. Is like, I have never seen there's no downside to helping other filmmakers. It's a competitive business, but I don't believe that anybody's taking anybody's seat unless it's literally, you know, somebody being picked for the same project over somebody else. That's a different story.
Yeah.
Helping another movie happen doesn't take anything away from your film.
No, you know what I mean? It doesn't.
It's like films don't split a pie per se. No. There's thousands of titles that come out a year, you know, worldwide. And we are already in a very sort of privileged part of the market by releasing English-speaking movies. That's a fact. On the indie level, you have to help each other because, first of all, it's a great way to network. And two, when you need help, if you're the one who put negative energy into the world, expect it to come back.
100%, Alex. It's so true. We just won't. Even though most of them we probably would, but actually, if they keep being, and then suddenly it's like, oh well, can you help me on this? We go, no, do you know what? I've got a lot of the people I could help before you. Let me help them first, and you know, it's true. You can't be negative.
Well, everybody knows the story. If you're a dick, everybody knows you're a dick.
It gets around very quick. Even on Clubhouse, we're all talking about it. In the WhatsApp groups afterwards, we're all talking about it. If you're a dick, mate, you get pushed out. It's very simple. Don't be a dick in this industry. Don't think you're too big for your boots after one film or whatever it is. It's a long reputation career.
It's hard to shake off a reputation. You know, when you have so much talent out there, and I'm talking about it's not just casting, it's not just the directors or producers, it's also in heads of departments everywhere. Being seen as problematic or trouble to work with, it's a hard reputation to shake off.
It really is. And
you know, obviously we some of them are wrong, some of them are the reputation that comes out is wrong, and I've seen this. I've seen people just saying, we didn't get along on that shoot, and now people, you know, I've heard that. But there are some certain things when you hear it from several people, it starts to stick. And so it's just being kind to people and being, you know, trying to help when you can. Everybody understands you can't always help, and you can't always, you know, some help demands more than others. But when you can, why not?
Why not? Exactly. It's so important to do it. It's a really small industry. Support and help as much as you can. It will come back to you. Sound of Violence is a real testament to how indie films should be made. It's such a cool movie. You stuck by what you wanted and you made a cracking film, which is only going to stand you in good stead for the next one. And I know you're collaborating with some amazing people for the next one. So good luck. Final bit of advice you've given so much for any filmmaker coming up now. What's the most important thing that you think you could give? Again, don't be a dick. We've said quite a bit, but anything else?
Don't only do what people expect of you. And I know it's sometimes tough. Like once in a while, you're like, my movie should be this, or I should do that, or I should align into by the time you start making your film to the moment you deliver it, things have changed four times around. So you don't know what the trend is necessarily going to be. Stick by your story. If you believe in your story and it's really burning inside of you, stick by it. Because the worst thing you can do is just comply and align. If you have a belief about the type of story you want to tell, it might take a little longer to get it off the ground, and you might get a lot of no's. We're in an industry of rejection. It's normal. But then when somebody's going to believe in it, and you're going to get to do that thing, that idea that's been burning the back of your head, this is when you're going to be the best filmmakers you can be. Or at least, you know, try to be. And it's important to know that commercial considerations are important to keep mm-hmm. in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But if they take over your creative process, your uniqueness as a filmmaker is what suffers. And it's better to make absolutely the best vision you had and get criticized for it than to make something that people are going to forget because it's just trying to please too many people. You're putting yourself out there. If you want a career in it, people need to know who you are. Mm-hmm. And if you're just releasing palate cleansers movies, who are you? You know, it's yeah. like it needs to be, you need to watch, you know, like when I watched Dare,
mm-hmm.
okay, that's an attention grabbing movie.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. You're just like, yeah, but the point is like, it's you know, when you release something like that, it's an experiment anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will just add one more thing. In horror, we have actually a luck that we get to be mad scientists. We are in the most experimental genre because nobody expects us to win. Nobody expects us to win awards, to be seen at the Oscars or to in all those things.
Yeah.
But so we get to be mad scientists. And what we do is the experimentation that serves cinema as a whole. And therefore, go for it. Be as experimental as you want.
Sound of Violence is out now. Go support Alex, but just generally support indie films. And this is one of them and you should be supporting. Do go watch it. It's fucking ace. Alex, I can't wait to see what you do next. You're an exciting filmmaker. I've loved meeting you. I think you've been a real exciting voice that's come through the Clubhouse scene, that's come through the indie filmmaking scene. And I'm delighted that I know you. And I think, you know, we're all growing up together in this little indie filmmaking world.
Likewise, my friend.
Great. It's fucking great. Where can people follow you? Where can they find you on the socials and bombard you with questions of filmmaking and love for your film, Sound of Violence?
And please do. Yeah, absolutely. Please don't hesitate to reach out. I love to have conversations about even if you hated my film, it's okay. We can talk about it.
Let's talk about it. Maybe not for long.
So I'm very simply at Alex Neuer. So my name, but just all together across socials. So essentially Twitter, Instagram. Yeah, you can find me on Clubhouse every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific from short to feature. And then I also joined the horror room Thursdays at 3:55 Pacific and yeah, midnight in the
midnight
UK.
Midnight UK, yeah.
And other than that, the UK is yes. getting one more chance to see the movie on the big screen.
When?
So we are going to play at the Dead of Night Festival mm-hmm. yep. in Liverpool.
Yeah.
On Sunday, 3rd of October.
There you go. So anyone near Liverpool or want to go up October the 3rd, I'll put links to all these things in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for taking your time to listen to the Filmmakers Podcast. If you do like this, tell your friends and family, not necessarily family, they might not be into film. Tell people who are into filmmaking because that's how we grow. And if you really like this, go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review. And if you really want to come and join the family, go on our Patreon, Filmmakers Podcast /Patreon or the other way around. You'll find it. Links in the show notes. And come and join us. For a little as a cup of tea, you get so much bonus material, of which Alex Neuer on this episode, there will be bonus materials from his chat on our Patreon coming up very soon. So come and join us. There's loads on there. It's amazing. It's a huge resource. Anyway, I've loved talking to you, Alex. This has been so good.
Thank you, my friend.
Really enjoyed this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jazz. And thank you, Lucinda.
Hey, Lucinda's back. Hello.
Hi, guys. So sorry about that. Jazz, always so embarrassing. I'm so sorry. Terribly rude of me. But we've just wrapped for the day. And on wrap, wow, everything goes mental. And it's a unit move tonight. So it means all the vehicles are going out, the makeup trucks, the laundry trucks, the three-ways, the catering trucks, everything. And I always like to stay to the end to support my team, even though it could be about 2 a.m. So so sorry, Alex, but thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful to talk to you, an absolute pleasure. You're a right character and hilarious. Love Sound of Violence, and I really hope to speak to you again soon. Take care, lovely.
And remember, you can go out there and make your indie film. You can make it happen, and if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, just as Alex has done, it is your duty to send the elevator back down. See you next Tuesday. As always. Bye, Alex.
Bye.
Bye, Lucinda.
Bye now.